So our next presentation, this one was supposed to be called The Little State That Could. Well, now we're going to hear about a not-so-little country that did. And our presenter is Dr. Claudia Chauffan, who is an MD and PhD at the Institute for Health and Aging Social Behavioral Sciences at UCSF right here in San Francisco. She's an assistant professor of sociology and health policy at the Institute for Health and Aging. She teaches sociology of health and medicine, comparative and international healthcare systems, sociology of power, and sociological theory. Her research includes the political economy of diabetes and obesity, the sociology of human genetic research, comparative and international healthcare systems, and health and human rights. She's vice president of Physicians for National Health Program, California.
So, good afternoon, everybody. And, healthcare justice lessons from Taiwan. I think that Taiwan has, in many ways, achieved what we all long for. So let me tell you the story of Taiwan. I have no commercial conflicts of interest to disclose, and Martha already mentioned my conflict of interest of, so to speak, being the vice president of the California chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, so you know where I stand. This is what I'm going to talk about 5 minutes each. Why Taiwan? I'll tell you a little bit the personal and the political. How did they get single-payer universal health care? And how we can get from here to there. And here is the ACA, which is ACA in Spanish. And so it's a little bit of a pun. So the new kid in town, Taiwan is actually a small country. It's a very small country. It's a small island nation, about 180 kilometers off southeast China, across the Taiwan Strait. It's about the size of the state of Maryland, and I found this factoid that I thought you might be interested in, 283 times smaller than the United States. Its GDP is about 60% of ours, which places it as a relatively well-off country, so it's a developed country. And the population is of 23 million, 8% of which are Han Chinese, with a 2% of aboriginals, about 14 recognized, officially recognized tribes. Now, even though 98% of them are Han Chinese, they are a very culturally and religiously diverse population, as I had a chance to discover during my stay there. They see themselves as coming from different areas of China, South China, and also the different waves of immigration that are frequently, although not always, related to political issues and big political events, also give different segments of the population a very distinct and cultural outlook. And if you look at the age and sex distribution, you see that the population in Taiwan is aging. It's becoming older. And they're a little worried about that, but they're also very proud. They are very respectful of their elders. And women are delaying childbirth, and some of them, and of course they're not only delaying them, but having fewer and fewer children, some of them none at all. The country is a mix of urban centers and nature, and I had a chance to see a little bit, even if I was working, quite busy working, this fantastic contrast of urban development and big national parks and a lot of beauty, natural beauty. I put a picture of a 7-Eleven there because Taiwan has the highest concentration of 7-Eleven stores on the planet. And they take that kind of as a funny and unique feature of the country. They also have scooters all over the place, so you are always, I was always fearing that I would get run over by one of them, but I wasn't. And that's Taipei 101, a very tall and distinct building at the center of Taipei. The country is also a mix of worship and food. You have temples all over the place of a variety of religious persuasions, and all of them are surrounded by food, absolutely extraordinary food, very close to the temples and even inside them. And that's a picture of Susie, and we became very close friends. I hang out with her all the time because I couldn't figure out my way very easily at the beginning, and we became very fond of one another, so she called me her Taiwanese mom, and I my Taiwanese daughter. Taiwan has a very interesting history of repression and resistance, as part of a Cold War. The Taiwanese people have suffered a lot, both right and left, and that's a topic of a whole different presentation. Let me tell you about the personal now. I was invited as a visiting scholar the spring of 2012. It was a great luck and privilege to teach at the International Master's Program at Taipei Medical University. I've been fascinated with Taiwan's healthcare system for a long time, so I was eager to learn more about it. I had also a chance, as I was teaching, to interview a range of people in different positions, academics, policymakers, government officials, health providers, and also talk quite a bit to patients, people from their own experience. And I also received services myself, and so did my husband when he was visiting there. We had kind of a medical emergency, so we had opportunity to test the real thing, and we came out just marveled. Now, the political aspect of this is through the 1995, Taiwan had 10, or actually over 10 separate insurance pools or schemes, covering only 57% of the population, which means that 43% of the population was uninsured, and the costs were rising. So I think we kind of identify ourselves with that situation. Mm-hmm. Now, today, Taiwan offers comprehensive full coverage to 100% of the population. Well, that would be like 99.5 or something like that. They're always trying to figure out who's not actually getting health care. Their costs are only 6.25% of their GDP, although they are worried about their rising costs. I wish we had that problem. And the premiums are very affordable for individual Taiwanese or people living in the country. I try to give you a computation there. It's really quite simple. It's about a 5% premium rate plus a contribution ratio that varies depending on where in the workforce you are, plus yourself and your number of dependents. But it comes out to a very affordable amount that people usually, they never complain about that. And every time the government has tried to increase the premium rate, they've had, you know, to deal with massive social unrest, so they haven't done it. They have done it two or three times over the span of 17 years. They have fully free choice of providers, no gatekeepers. I don't personally think it's a good idea as a physician myself, but they don't like that. They don't like to be told where to go, and that's what they have. And they have virtually no waiting lines. You can literally walk up in a hospital or a clinic and say, you know, I want to see a physician. Well, you want to see a specialist or a primary care provider. And there you go. And there you're walked in. It's the system, they describe their system as very competitive, but providers compete for quality, not for price, because the price is set by the government. They have a fee, a price schedule, and drug formularies. And each patient carrying a smart card represents the dollars of the single-payer Bureau of National Health Insurance. So if you want to make money, you've got to see patients and give them services, and you better give them well, because otherwise they go see somebody else. Electronic medical records are all over the system. They're fully available throughout the system. They have none of these issues of interoperability because they didn't have the really bad idea of opening this to the market, so you have a gazillion different systems that can't talk to each other, even if you have two providers sitting right next to each other, quite literally, as I have had a chance to experience myself when I get healthcare in the United States. Their administrative overhead is very, very low, 1.5% for the system, and also it's very low for doctors because all you need to do is enter the information in the electronic medical record about your patient, that's communicated directly with the Bureau of National Health Insurance, and you get paid. And you swipe the patient card, and that's it. So when I was visiting, for instance, a nursing home with about 500 residents, I asked the head of the nursing home, so how many people do you hire to do your billing? So she looked back at me and stared at me, not quite understanding what I meant. I had to repeat the question literally two or three times. Well, how many people do you hire to do your billing? You mean the person that does our billing, it was one. Mm-hmm. So satisfaction rate, and surprisingly, of the system, of users of the system is very high, from 78%. Medical bankruptcies are non-existent, and I put a certain amount there to compare with the number of people affected per year in the United States by medical bankruptcies, even when they have health insurance, and the number of people who are affected by these bankruptcies were larger than the number of medical bankruptcies themselves. And of course, deaths for lack of health insurance are non-existent as well. And I actually asked the question to people who would stare back at me and didn't quite know what I was talking about. Just to give you a sense that some of you may not know, it has estimated that we have about 1,000 individuals per 1 million uninsured. And just for the record, after the Affordable Care Act is implemented, we will still have about 36 million uninsured. That's the last report I heard, because it started with 23, then it went up to 26, and then it went up to 30, and now we are in 36 million people uninsured. Not to speak of the number of underinsured by very thin insurance policies. They've had, the Taiwanese, as a result of this, health and other achievements, greater health equity, great healthcare equity, health equity, dramatic decrease in, you know, difference in mortality rates, increase in utilization rates without concomitant increase in healthcare costs, and they have a lot of very useful research, because the money that goes for research is immediately put into practice to find, you know, better ways of paying providers and so forth. They found out, for instance, doing pay-for-performance demonstrations, that it didn't really work for diabetic patients, because even though the results were very good, it led the providers to cherry pick the patients who would predictably have good results so that they would get paid more. So they've done that. How did they do it? Well, they needed to provide, this is, as again, I'm sort of summarizing the results of many, many conversations I had throughout my weeks there, month and a half. They needed to provide access to healthcare and to control escalating costs. They had a goal and commitment to solidarity and equity, and they were attracted to choice, freedom, personal responsibility, and competition. And I swear that I'm not making this up. These were the words articulated to me by my different interviewees. So they had a planning time or period, about 7 years. They sent experts to study countries throughout the world. They drew from Germany, Canada, U.S. Medicare features. They totally rejected the U.S. mixed or public-private partnership, as we like to call it, of financing and including commercial for-profit insurers. And they chose comprehensive single-payer that I've talked about already that includes fee-for-service. They didn't modify that, although they're trying to, but it's not easy. Fee-for-service within global budgets for different sectors of the system, not for individual establishments, and I can explain more of that in the Q&A. They came up with a car that has been domestically designed and produced, but with many components from a variety of other countries. Well, you may still wonder, how did they do it? Give me the punchline. I mean, I know how they did it, but how did they do it? Well, they had social background of popular discontent, sound familiar too, I think, increasing insurance and costs of care. But they also had a political background of election time, opposition, the opposition party, the Democratic Progressive Party, supporting single payer. So the incumbent, the Kuomintang, incorporated single payer into their platform, and guess what? They won the election. So the way I put it to myself is they had great political leadership, but popular pressure that made it politically impossible for the Taiwanese government not to implement single payer. So let me give you a few selected quotes. These are my students. They're all smiling generally. Services are good. I'm grateful to be living in Taiwan. We're having dinner there. You're always having food when you talk to people. In the U.S., you have Medicaid for the poor. That's wrong, because they tell you we'll give you health care only if you spend down. Some selected quotes. Medical bankruptcies? No, none. And this is the Deputy Director General of the BNHI, Bureau of National Health Insurance, telling me very proudly how the single-payer, publicly funded system can supply for the needs of people with very rare and extremely expensive medical conditions, expensive because they have to buy their medications from us, the US, and we do not cut them a break, but they still cover their needs, even if these folks do not live very long. And this is the first CEO of the National Bureau of Health Insurance, very proudly showing me his insurance card, his smart card. With this card, everybody gets the same care in my country. And we didn't allow commercial insurance. Insurers, he said, they're murderers. And he laughed, and I was wondering what he was laughing at. So this is, I'm not putting the picture there, that's the doctor who showed me his practice, and he said that the system is a miracle, patients are very happy, and guess what, doctors are really unhappy. Even though he makes 4 or 5 times the income of a university professor, he thinks I work really hard, he told me, right? And I was wondering, well, what does he think I do, right? He never had student debt, by the way, so where can we get from there to here? I'm sorry, from here to there, I mean. Well, obviously, expanded and improved Medicare for all, building on the history, experience, and structure of the Medicare we have. So what if the Democrats lose? It doesn't really matter. We won't get them with them, we won't get them without them. It doesn't really matter, it doesn't make a difference. Here I'm showing you just the top 20 Senate recipients of health insurance campaign contributions, the decade of the 2000 through 2008. So we need to go out in the streets to get real healthcare for all. Thank you very much.